Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schenkelberg.
And this is Chris Jackson. We were talking about statistics and how we can be better at using them in a practical way.
Well, I think there's using it, but there's also wanting to use it. Learning about statistics. I think there's two parts to that. One is, yeah, it's a great set of tools. There's a wonderful toolkit in my career anyway, that it's worked out great and allowed me to add value to all kinds of programs and projects and decisions. Yet, is one of the statistics that's up on the site. I don't think I told you about this one. Maybe I did last week. Is that for whatever reason, the number one article on the site, which hasn't really changed a whole lot over the last couple of years, it's been risk management techniques for years, is Google loves and people are searching for how to do risk management. But in the last month, it's become point estimate or a point and confidence estimate. And that was the title of the article. And it was a very short article, and it has the how do you take a set of data, a sample set of data, calculate the mean, and a confidence interval around it. Very straight out of textbook 101, you know, simple, basic calculations, showed the formulas, did an example. And I wrote it 8 years ago. And it's rocketed to the top. It accounts for like 3 or 4, almost 5% on some days of the total traffic to the site.
Well, that's obviously coming to your site very specifically to inform a decision or answer a question. I think that's first and foremost.
Yeah, but I think it's also, my theory is that it's, they don't want to pull out their old stats book, which they didn't keep beyond the end of the class, if they had the class, and they go, I need to figure out, is it a t-distribution? What's that formula? And then they look it up, basically. It's a whole range of different keywords that people are, or queries that people are typing in. I looked it up the other day, and it must be 30 or 40 different ways people ask a question saying, well, what's the formula for the mean and standard deviation, or the mean and confidence interval on a sample mean? And yeah, it's baffling. I mean, I look into it when I see something change like that, because it's different. And it's not like I'm doing control charts or monitoring all this stuff real closely or anything, but when something varies that much. And then it made me think, when we were talking about, you know, you were talking about a course you're putting together and using bread baking to illustrate some of the points of measurement systems and monitoring it and controlling it and stuff like that. And reminded me of making cookies for a basic design of experiments introduction course. Because you could do it, you could put your hands on it, you could think through all the things. Unless you're completely adverse, have never been in a kitchen, you could relate to it. If nothing else, you could relate to eating them. Yep. I don't remember bread making or cookie baking in my stats classes. It was usually an urn with red and blue beads or black and white beads. I mean, it was, who walks around with an urn full of random colored beads? It's like, what?
And I think one of the biggest criticisms that bosses and colleagues have of the resident statistician in the organization is that they use terms that aren't relatable. And not only are they aren't relatable, just aren't relevant. So
we have 6 degrees of freedom in this situation. So therefore it means, what? What are you talking about?
Is that a milling machine, or is that, people don't know what degrees of freedom means when you're referencing it in that context. And I think one of the easiest ways to improve the practicality of statistics is to improve the practicality of statistics, which means that when you talk to someone, don't use degrees of freedom or shape parameters or standard deviations or anything else that doesn't help them understand in a very direct way what the answer to their question is.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where I think that we can make sure that if we know what our decision maker is wanting to understand, we say, well, our best guess is that we think as of right now, 7% of our things are going to fail during warranty period. That's a statistic.
Yep.
That's the output of a statistical conversation and data analysis.
Means something. Yeah, it means something, and they can relate to it and they can translate it. Instead of saying after 45 minutes of derivations and formulas and charts and graphs and pie, you know, and then you put out a pie chart and you give them 7% versus the 93%, but then there's some uncertainty. So, and it gets buried, absolutely buried. Mm. And I actually did that once on purpose. This one guy I really didn't like. He was kind of a show off. And they asked me to do some data analysis. This is a basic statistics thing. So I did the full derivation in the preceding. And therefore, the answer is 2.
And right.
He didn't even know where to start asking questions. It's like, yeah, shut up with all your chemical engineering knowledge. I can do statistics.
I've had a slightly worse version of that where someone is the statistical guy in the organization. And so they always go to him to find, you know, to he's a statistical gatekeeper.
Yep.
And unfortunately, he enjoyed being the gatekeeper more than he enjoyed being competent at statistics. And so he was often he's often essentially shutting the gate on all sorts of things they were trying to do.
Mm-hmm.
And that meant that one of the reasons I was there to help out was to get around one of their own guys in that context.
Oh, wow.
It was bad, but yeah, and that's what that sort of mindset gives statistics and statisticians a bad name. So the very first thing you can do is when you're talking to someone about statistics, use a statistic that matters to them, is relevant to them, and is relatable. That makes it more practical every single day.
Oh yeah, there's that. It was a few years ago, I was talking to some at a conference, some professor at some campus and stuff like that. And it was something I was railing about somebody's lack of understanding of statistics from an engineering point of view. It was a mechanical engineer, design engineer of some sort. Somebody was like, they're not even interested in the statistics at all. And we're dealing with manufactured parts and variability and tolerancing and all these other things that statistics as an aggregate set of tools is the right place to be and the right things to use to make really much better decisions. And mm-hmm. and she understood all that. And she says, but we don't have a statistics department. It used to be in math. And we had a couple of classes for those that wanted to dive into it. And we had an undergrad class, problem stats, that was required for any of the engineering STEM students, basically. And we stopped doing it because nobody ever wanted to go to the course. It was low ranked and rated. Nobody enjoyed it. Our engineering stuff is we don't deal with manufactured parts. We're dealing with the theory, you know, here's the strength of this beam and the weight of it. And it goes, but you know that not every beam is the same. And if you don't account for the variability in that actual physical beam from one to the next, the theory is only a starting point. And he understood that. And he says, what we're supposed to do is fit into our already overburdened courses a module on statistics. And it's not coordinated or anything else. And she says, yeah, it's going across all kinds of campuses. And I asked around informally, and it was like very few places anymore had a standalone statistics sequence of courses or courses that were part of the engineering curriculums. Mm-hmm. And so you could go through an engineering degree and never have a course on statistics or probability and stats. And I thought, that's just not good.
No.
That's and I find it, you know, as I talk to clients today, I find there's fewer and fewer people that have suffered through the undergrad stats course.
Yeah, so it's not good that engineers aren't learning statistics and a lot of statistic courses aren't good.
Right. Well, you know, that kind of sums it up. It's But you mentioned something before we got on the air that you were putting together this course and you were using bread baking. And I don't know if you, and I think you knew that I like making bread. I make bread every couple of weeks for the house. And and so I was interested in how we were using it. And it was, I think the, I said, well, what are you measuring? You know, chewability in it.
Chewability. Yeah.
It's like,
who would have thought?
Yeah. But if I'm going to, I'd be, in, I mean, just because I'm interested in baking, I would be fascinated with this course. It'd be, what? How do you, and I pay more attention to the chewability measurement and how do I can optimize my bread baking to make it work. But it's part of, it's just relatable.
Right.
Instead of beads in an urn or, you know, shuffling three decks of cards. What?
Well, I mean, when I first started developing this example or this central sort of central example for my courses based on processes and manufacturing and things like that, I was immediately drawn to bread making. And then when I first saw the idea or the concept of chewability, I thought, oh, okay, so someone is making up this sort of thing you expect to see on moisturizing commercials where they say this will reduce visible wrinkles by 75%, all those sorts of airy-fairy metrics that you, it just sounds like someone's made up and tried to put a number against it to make it sound objective. But it turns out that chewability actually, no, is a very carefully measured ability of the bread to firstly resist compression, spring back to its original
dimensions, I would say.
Dimensions, yep, yep. And the amount of force you initially need to start biting into the bread. It's actually, there are specific test rigs out there that are able to measure the chewability of bread. And it's not because it's necessarily trying to specifically replicate what every human being in the world is going to think chewability means. That's not possible, but it's supposed to be analogous enough to help you understand when your process is starting to go out of control.
Hmm. When I pulled out the black smoldering chunk of coal that I forgot in the oven, I think the chewability was beyond the scale at that point. It was
right. It would have had a lot of hardness, which is the force you need to compress it by a certain preset strain.
It would not have come back. It would have just crushed into dust. And
right.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, I wasn't going to bite into it. Now, I've had toasts like that, too. But I think, you know, the analogy and the idea of using something that's tangible, and it is scientific. I think you landed on something that's cool on top of just something that's relatable. And it's something you can put in the room. You know, you can say, here's the variability. Here's three loaves of bread. They're different. might or might not need to do that. But the idea is that it's something tangible. It reminded me of when I was first learning a whole raft of different kinds of quality tools and statistic tools and practical use of them and stuff like that in this where I work. I got assigned teach a intro to design of experiments, do an L4 array. And she recommended using cookies. Go get two couple boxes of cookies and let's use those and we'll bake them overnight. And then we'll measure them the next day and we'll run out the math on this array. And it was quick. It was easy. It was immediately understandable. It went through all the steps of going through the analysis and setting up the experiment and running the experiment and everything else. And it didn't cost a whole lot. It wasn't like we're using the polymers that we're doing and would take 3 days to create a product. And then we'd have to go figure out how to measure it. It was very informative and very fun. I think there was a piece of that was there. And it was for a practical purpose so that we could then relate it to the electronics we're working with, the measurement systems we're working with, the manufacturing processes we're working with and made that work. But she did that regularly. It was every week somebody on the team would be, hey, go learn enough about this to tell us the rest of us about it. So we learn measurement system analysis. We learn, you know, hypothesis testing, control charting, design of experiments, and on and on and on. And it was just kind of practical intros, what was relevant to what we needed to know. And then we were encouraged then to go practice it, go try it. We're on the floor all the time anyway. Our manufacturing director, he was like, do an experiment every day and do the analysis, right, run it out. And so we learned a ton of stuff just by practice constantly. But that's not the way a stats course is taught. They also, most colleges don't happen to have a manufacturing facility right outside your door.
Well, that's not how most stats courses are taught, we should probably say. But lots of universities aren't interested in manufacturing. They just simply aren't, because it's not intellectually intriguing. Manufacturing comes down to...
Until you get on the floor and actually look around a little bit, and there's a lot of complicated stuff going on.
Right.
Come on.
A good manufacturing engineer is potentially the most valuable engineer in your organization, potentially, mm-hmm. because it's all well and good coming up with fantastically novel and technically feasible or implementable design. But if it's impossible to manufacture consistently and reliably and cheaply, and I remember one example of where manufacturability was forgotten, where one piece needed to be glued to another piece in a very particular way. Mm-hmm. And it had to be, the way it was designed, had to be done by hand. And for whatever reason, there's only one 60-year-old lady who had the knack of being able to glue it in the right way.
Yep.
And no one else could do it. Everyone tried to copy her, emulate her, whatever, couldn't do it. It was just whatever she was doing was what held everything together. So she was flown across the world to individually glue these parts together, because she was the only one who could possibly do it. She didn't know what she was doing in terms of...
I do it like what? This. I'll show you. You do it like this. Yeah. But there's pressure, there's force, there's level. I mean, there's lots and lots of factors that go into that. That would be a study in itself. I imagine that when she had one of her kids had a baby, she flew off for a month in production shutdown.
Possibly. It was that bad. I mean, if she was off, production shut down because no one else could replicate it.
Yeah.
And that's not, I mean, people were laughing about how crazy is that? But they're laughing at the wrong thing. Yep. They should have been laughing or crying at the fact that they did not make manufacturing a design characteristic that mattered enough. And that's where, if you have an exclusively theoretical understanding of your design and don't take into consideration the variation between individual workers on the production line, then you're going to come up with these ridiculous constraints where you need whatever her name is, Gertrude, to allow the entire production of this very expensive device to continue.
Yeah. Now, I've heard a couple of stories like that, the manufacturing process really hinged on this one machine that was near mm-hmm. impossible to replicate. And we had a measurement system that was based on an HP 35, I think it was. It was one of the early mini computer, it had a tape for the output. It had a roll of tape, and it would print. A dot matrix printer would print the output. Didn't have a screen. It had a keyboard. You could put in commands, but it wasn't a screen. It was just this tape. And we tried with all kinds of different machines to try to replicate the measurement process that it did, and the timing of it and everything else. And we went into great detail measuring all these things and factoring them in and programming it, and we could not replicate it. And so director of engineering then said, go buy all of these machines that you can go find. And we ended up with a closet full of like 40 of these computers.
Right.
Just because if it didn't work, our production was shut down.
Right.
And so when a machine would die, if we couldn't repair it or whatever, we had spares that would get us through until we eventually cracked the nut of how to, and it would never, I was there 11 years and we never figured out how to do it. But we had plenty of spares. So it wasn't a top priority, but it would be someday. But the idea though is statistics is important. And some of us get bit but because we don't take that into account. We set up, a design engineer puts in tolerancing independent of what's the actual variability of the materials. Just because you want it to be really tight tolerance and you want this very cheap, rough method for production because of cost, there's a good chance you can't get there from here. You're going to have lots of scrap, or you're going to have lots of problems, or you're going to shorten life on the product, all kinds of issues. So in a very practical sense, it fits in into our world. Customer use profiles vary. The time to failure of all these different failure mechanisms vary. In your webinars, Chris, you have the now famous random hand of chance, you know, kind of dropping
random variables. Oh,
yeah, no, we should, you know, get a little trademark it, or make a little sign for it. You know, people can t-shirts. That's what we need. We need t-shirts. But the basic idea is that the problem is that universities and so on are to large extent, in my opinion, I think we've talked about it before, focus on the theory and all this other stuff that you know, engineers and scientists should be familiar with to some degree. And we could argue about whether this or that or the other thing is more important. But you get thrown into the practical world. And I've heard from a number of different organizations in the last few years is that they don't have time to teach basic statistics. Not like when I was there and we were getting this every week and encouraged to go do experiments just to keep learning. That's rare. Now it's you come in with the skills you got and you deliver, and we don't have time for training. You don't go to conferences. If you want to take a course, do it on your own time. And So we're kind of squeezing ourselves out of this fundamental knowledge around statistics. And I think it explains in part why Ascendo's number one article now is how to calculate an average. It's something you can find. You know, somebody knew that they needed to go find that and they went and got it. But the problem I run into is, well, what if somebody isn't even aware of design of experiments? They don't know where to go look for. They might end up reinventing algorithms to do Taguchi arrays and call it the Bernstein arrays because that's their name.
Let's call out BS where we should. No organization has the time to not do statistics courses or whatever it is you need to empower your employees to make the best decisions on a daily basis. I guarantee you the organization I was talking about where they needed Gertrude on hand every single day to make production happen would have said that one point in time, we don't have the time to go and teach our designers to think about manufacturability, or we don't have the time to teach our designers or technicians about variation and statistics so they can take this into consideration when they're setting tolerances. Mm-hmm. They would have convinced themselves they don't have the time to do these things. And from a very immediate perspective and cultural perspective, and they're looking around and the boss is breathing down their neck for schedules and this, that, the other, it might feel like you don't have the time. But I guarantee you they did not have the time to deal with the ultimate reality, which was that Gertrude turned out to be the only diamond in the rough who was essentially the on-off switch for your entire production facility.
Yep.
You don't have the time for that. So work out what you don't have the time for and then run with it.
Yeah. Well, I've also seen teams that say, we don't have time for that. It's a basic skill. People should just know that. And I says, well, you know, our systems and our engineering teams and stuff are not supporting that. But we do. Why is it we have time for classes on additive manufacturing or artificial intelligence or, you know, Bitcoin investing? Why are those the classes we're offering? It's like, if we don't have a good understanding of how the world works and varies, none of those really much matter.
Well, and even if you're right in that someone says, oh, this should be a foundational skill, they should turn up with this skill ready to go. Well, they're not. People aren't. So are you going to keep admiring the problem or are you going to actually do something about it? It's a reality.
It is.
You can say this shouldn't happen, but well, it is.
It is.
But it shouldn't happen. Okay. Well, let's just keep doing U-turns around this particular bit of controversy, and let's move on.
Yeah. So anyway, I'm looking forward to hearing more about this course you're working on or developing with bread baking. I'll take it just for the discussion about chewability and how to measure it, that kind of stuff. But I think part of the opportunity, and this is probably a discussion for us more offline around developing Ascendo, is that it fits that niche. We can help people practically learn statistics so that they can do their job better. And I think it's not the sole purpose of Ascendo, but it's such a central piece to so many other things that we deal with, that it is a vital set of tools and skills to at least be competent with. You don't have to be master statistician at grandmaster level or anything like that, win competitions and calculating confidence bounds. Are there such things? Are there competitions for this? Maybe that's it. It's just not popular. It's not like it's not on ESPN. So it's just doesn't get the press.
Well, I mean, if hot dog eating competitions are increasingly relevant these days, which they are, maybe there is a, and spelling bees, yeah, spelling bees on TV. So
I know, yeah, you know, we could start that. We'll have to explore that. Well, anyway, if you're listening to this and wondering where in the world we're going with this random discussion of variability, let us know. Or if you've got a decent story or a reasonable story or a question around statistics and how to help your organization understand the language of variability, we'd love to hear from you. What's working, what's not, that kind of stuff. Head over to ascendoreliability.com/go/SOR, and you can find a way to leave us a voice message or a written message. Find Chris and I and the other hosts of the show up on LinkedIn or on our About pages. We have plenty of ways for you to join the conversation. And I'm thinking I've got that pretty much down. It's not pre-recorded, so I know it varies slightly, but I do that little spiel so often now that I should probably really think about it and change it up sometimes. But
you've become what Gertrude was to that manufacturer I was talking about. You're now that guy for Ascendo.
That's right. Well, I ran into that the other day recording with Carl. He goes, "And Fred, how can they get in touch with us?" I says, "Carl, you've heard it 47,000 times. How, you don't know it?" He goes, "No, I never." You always say it. You can call me Gertrude now.
That's right.
All right. Thanks, Chris. We'll talk to you soon.
Cheers, Fred. Always a pleasure.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation if you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show. Please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.